I'm proud that I was able to put my own name down and put one fight in the history books for myself.
Without a shadow of a doubt, I mean, you both pushed yourself to a limit that I think is beyond expected of you. How did you get through it? Because those were some very, very hard rounds for both of you.
Just grit.
I mean, what got you through it more than anything?
Just not wanting to bow out, not wanting to take a knee, not wanting to go down the heart of it. I want to, when I realised I wasn't boxing the best, I knew I could rely on my heart and being proud of that side of me. So that's why I had to double down in that fight, and I'll take that for what it's worth.
No, it was amazing. One question on the future. Maybe not the time to ask it. There will be people asking for you, yes, because it was so good. You spoke to him. He's obviously going to ask one. Would you do it again, or do you now believe that you'd be on this level? What do you want to do in the immediacy of that?
Yeah, look, I think he deserves it. I'm a fair man, and that was a great fight. And he deserves a rematch. He deserves to be a clearer win. A lot of people will ask for it, and I don't think I'll be happy with my career moving on from that draw and just running away from it. So we can run it back.
Hello, and welcome back to the number one podcast in the sport, where we can finally give Ben Shalom his first W as a promoter. So I think, based on what he delivered on Easter Sunday, we can say there's a chance that boxers are getting their act together and understanding what it takes to win the hearts and minds of boxing fans. But not only that, but to create a buzz that reverberates outside of that inner circle of hardcores and maybe a few concentric circles out into that broader mainstream. And Easter Sunday was a time where we saw what boxer could potentially produce for the boxing fans. So one of the questions I get asked a fair bit is, what makes a good boxing card? And there are probably loads of things, but I think you can bring it down to themes, right? So when you look at the great cards, one thing you always have is a reason to be excited. What you also need is a reality check in there somewhere. What you need is something that's just absolutely bonkers. And then you need a redemption story. And then you need a main event that delivers. Now, your main event may contain all of those elements, but your main event has to deliver. And if we look at what the Wardley-Clark card did, it delivered. And the reason I say it delivered is if you go down that whole card, you look, Callum Simpson gives us reason to hope. He will receive his reality check at some point. But right now, we're looking at Callum Simpson going, the sky's the limit. So that's always a nice feeling to have. We got a reality check with Ben Whittaker. Ben, you're not going to knock everyone out. But Ben Whittaker still looked good, still looked mean, still looked vicious doing what he does. And a lot of people are going to say, yeah, but he didn't knock him out. We're going to have to judge his opponent by his next fight. So let's see what happens after this, because he may just have one of those freakish chins. We also had just absolute lunacy, Steve Robinson versus Alan Babich, which just a mad fight, isn't it? And I think that's what Alan Babich will always give you, just that bit of raw insanity. Either he goes or his opponent goes. So it gave you that. You got your redemption with Chris Kongo. I think you got another reality check with Vidal Riley, and then you got the main event. Don't know if I'm going to touch on all of them, because I don't know if people's ears want all of that, but we're definitely going to start with the main event. The names Fabio Wardley and Fraser Clark have been kind of woven together since last year. You know, they were due to face each other for the British, and there's a whole scandal around Fraser being pulled out of those discussions, and people saying, you know, why is he scared, and so on and so forth. And at the time, Ben Shalom took a lot of stick for his stance, but what he said was, when we make the fight, you'll understand why we did what we did. And with hindsight, we can say he was 100% right. Up until that point, Fraser hadn't shown us anything that had us believing he was anything other than an Olympian that's been given a good contract, right? He hadn't. And he said that himself. People saying he's being overly critical of himself. He was being true, because he's an Olympic bronze medalist. There's a certain trajectory he should be on by now. And he understood that. And so we patiently waited. The fights happened in the interim that needed to happen. You know, Fabio got the Saudi check for Boxing Adelaide and so forth. And then we arrive at the fight in April, well, tail end of March 2024. And we go, okay, fine. What are we going to get here? And I think I said at the time, this would be a clash of, you know, if you look at Fraser Clark, big, strong, solid man. Like, you imagine that if a bullet went in the front, it would never come out the back. He's that solid. I mean, he crazily solid. Not a guy you'd want to mess with. And so he's got that solidity to him. You know, he always gave the impression he could really take a shot. The only question was, has he got the power? And B, has he got the stamina? Because he's coming in at 19, so I think he weighed in at 266 pounds on the day before the fight. And then you look at Fabio, and so Fabio's big tick is he can put anyone down. And you always get the impression that once he lets his hands go, it's a matter of time. He's very, very heavy-handed, which people don't understand, but he's incredibly heavy-handed. And that helps with a very limited skill set because it means that when those shots do land, they mean something. But there's always that question about Fabio that, you know, what can he do down the stretch, both from a stamina perspective and just mentality-wise, what can he do down the stretch? So there were so many unanswered questions, whereas, you know, people have been talking about these guys like they were the real deal. I think those in the know were looking at it going, no, we're going to find out a lot today. And so we did find out a lot. If you look at the trainers as well, at various points, both those trainers, Angel Fernandez and Ben Davison, have been called plastic trainers, YouTube trainers. They've been seen as a gimmick. And I think that's massively unfair. The reason it's unfair is those guys have had enough years doing this now where whatever knowledge gaps they had at the beginning, they can't have now. So now you've got to look at these guys as bona fide boxing trainers. And so we can start to look at, you know, who did what, you know, tactics, fighter development, you know, did they make a difference? I've always had the view that trainers make very little difference to what someone actually does in the ring. They can do a lot to create an environment for success. Yes, there's a lot of that stuff. But in terms of them being magicians, it's very hard to be a magician as a boxing trainer. I'll tell you that for nothing. But so prior to the bell, I thought, if I'm Wardley, I'm staying mobile. I'm throwing those 3-4 punch combinations. I'm letting Fraser Clark feel the weight, but I'm moving because I want to test his stamina. At 19 stone, is he really a 19 stone man? Is he one of those guys? And you meet some of them, right? A guy's like 18 and a half stone, 19 stone, with a resting heart rate of like 55 beats a minute. You get a few freaks like that. I've played rugby with guys. There was one guy, he had a heart rate at rest of 49 beats per minute, which was absolutely insane. So he'd never get tired, could just run all day, never had to come off, could just run all day. Wasn't fast, wasn't anything, but he was an 80-minute player. And that's always an asset when, especially sort of like sub-pro level, you don't always have a full bench. But so that was what we wanted to know. Now, what's the gas tank? Let's move Fraser around. Let's see what happens when he's not hitting a stationary target. What can he do? And then if you're Fraser Clark, tactically, what you're trying to show is the difference in class. Now, Fraser Clark is pretty much a lifelong boxer, right? He's been on that radar for 15 years. So since he was a junior, he's been considered to be one of the good ones. So there's a certain level of skill, knowledge, and experience Fraser should have, and that's what he had to impose on Fabio Wardley. So punches that only experienced people would throw, little tactics. You know, you've got to show your class. You've got to show your class, you've got to show your pedigree. That's what Fraser had to do, as well as impose the size on Fabio. And then see, you know, has Fabio ever had to deal with someone with this level of sophistication? Because as much as David Adlai's been talked up to the hills, David Adlai's no Fraser Clark when it comes to skills and experience. He may be just as raw as Fabio is. So it's this intriguing setup where you're not 100% confident anyone's going to get knocked down, but you get the impression that this is really going to turn on a couple of key things. And one of them was always going to be stamina, and the other one was going to be, what's the real gap in class? because Fraser Clark's got all the pedigree and all the class. Wardley had that fight-changing power. And I think that's kind of where you boil everything down to. And so as you're watching the fight, you start to realize Fraser Clark's jab is a completely different level to Fabio's. Fabio holds this really, it's a really odd stance, which seems to be a legacy from his white collar days, where he'll hold his arm out and it's not really, it's not provoking a response from the opponent. It's just kind of there, and it's more there out of habit than any sort of tactical nous. And what it does is it limits the effect of the jab, because it travels a shorter distance, but then it has less impact. Whereas you saw with Fraser Clark, that's a classic jab, hit the target, rock Fabio back. And the question then became, how does Fabio deal with that? And he dealt with it by, you know, classic boxing once again, right? So he dealt with it by coming back over the top. So either pulling back and firing his backhand, pulling out to the side and firing his backhand, and Fraser Clark was taking those right hands. There were some times where Fabio wouldn't let his feet come with him, so he was sort of not landing them. But they were the two shots that kind of came to define the fight for a while. And then Fraser Clark found joy with the right uppercut, which, not enough heavyweights throw for a start, right? Like, it kept landing. He found a home for it because Fabio kept dipping the wrong way, kept dipping to his left, and he gave that opening for Fraser just to land that, and then Fraser could go to the body. And you could see that the pedigree was with Fraser because he was just making slightly better boxing decisions, but raw athleticism, power, you know, that kind of, those shots that do damage down the stretch were coming from Fabio. And it was, can he do enough of these before these jabs and sort of that unseen work Fraser's doing starts to wear on him? Because, you know, Fraser was leaning on him, and that's Fabio having to carry 19 stone when Fabio was probably, well, a meaty end of 17. That's a lot of work. And so as you're watching this develop, yeah, and by the way, like, I'm not giving it justice. Like, it's becoming a compelling fight. And, you know, you start to text your friends and go, you might want to be watching this, guys. But what we're all going to really remember is the fight turned on two key moments. It turned on round five, where Fraser gets a knockdown. And you look at it now with hindsight and you wonder, was he actually hurt, or was it just him being overwhelmed with the force of Fabio's shots and being off balance? It felt a bit like that, because he seemed to get himself back together pretty well. And that's not to say that he wasn't hurt a few times in that fight, because my goodness, he was. We can add in the cut to Fabio's nose, which, mate, laid waste to his nose. And you wonder whether that was a result of sort of legacy nose trauma. Because sometimes what happens, if you've taken too many shots to the nose, you build up this really hard scar tissue. And you have 10-ounce gloves from a super heavyweight, hitting that can easily split the skin. Didn't they say Ricky Hatton had a similar problem, that because they had done his cut wrong, I think they'd filled one of his cuts with Vaseline, and they had never cleaned out the Vaseline, so that he had these sort of crystals in his eye. Now, this may just be an old wives' tale, but every time he got hit, he'd get cut because they hadn't done it properly. So they had to almost go in there, find all these crystals and clean them out before he could sort of say he'd address his issues with cuts. So the cut was a factor. I think Fraser getting knocked down was a factor, because once you start getting 10-8 rounds, it means you got to win more rounds than maybe you'd budgeted for. You know, if you thought, right, if I can win 7 rounds, I'm good. Once you got a 10-8 round, you got to push a little harder. And maybe that started to affect him psychologically. Being dropped by Fabio Wardley, that can hurt your pride too. Another pivotal point was round 7, when Fraser got deducted a point for low blows. And he's been pulled up for this numerous times. And I say to people, this is a problem that comes from bag work. Now, bag work's important, but if you're not on point and sharp with your bag work, and you're not focused on accuracy, you're just hitting the bag, loading up because you want to make the bag swing, or maybe you want to rip the bag off its mounting, that's when you start to see those sorts of crazy shots. You know, those sort of wide arcing shots. So when I coach people, I like my shots to just be sharp, snappy, you know, small arcs of motion, because there's less risk of strain. But the ref had warned Fraser. And so the point deduction was harsh in the context of the fight, but I can understand where it's come from. You know, you've got to referee the situation as you see it. So you got a 10-8 round plus a point deduction. That's a lot of pressure to try and make it back, because now it's not necessarily just the case of I can box my way to victory. It's like I could, but now it's a high risk strategy to box my way to victory. I might need to drop Fabio or stop him. And maybe that hadn't been Frazier's plan to begin with, but it had to become Frazier's plan from the end of the 7th round. But by that point, you could see both men were tired. So it was like, who's going to stop who? And it was more a feeling of maybe someone will just drop due to exhaustion. And all through this fight, I was feeling, if Fabio can just see this out to the end of the 12th, I don't know if Frazier's engine's going to sustain it. And you could see Frazier was struggling. If you knew what to look for, you could see it. But he doesn't give it away, because he just keeps putting the shots out and keeps giving judges that impression that he's working. And you know, that's what a good amateur pedigree does for you. It teaches you to just do those little things that you know affect the perception of the judge. And Fabio will learn this, I think, with time and experience. But I'll say this, where Fabio was crafty was a low shot to the groin, and really making a big meal of that, getting the referee's head, get the extra time to rest, regroup and recover. You know, those sorts of things, people complain about them, but I understand. You know, you got to play to the full span of the rules. Frazier did it. I think he spat his gum shield out a couple of times just to get some air in. Understandable. Take your warnings. Just make sure you don't lose a point for anything. But I think the 10-8 round and losing a point kind of made it really hard for Frazier to win. And as you got to those last three rounds, rounds 10, 11, and 12, and you start to just go, these men have literally run themselves into the ground. And the last three rounds, Fabio Wardley was just going on raw instinct. That was the white-collar Fabio Wardley. That was the guy who was like, it's him or me, and it's not going to be me today. And Frazier was in the same mindset, because Fabio was showing his tiredness more than Frazier was. Frazier kind of knew how to keep it composed. And Fabio, yeah, man, he might not make it to the end, but he was clever enough to keep tying up, holding, and he knew how to get his breath back. You know, he just kept holding on, making the referee work a little harder to separate them. You know, maybe walking to the wrong corner so the ref had to correct him. All these little things you do just to buy yourself a little bit more time. You know, let some of that lactate dissipate from the body, and then you go again. And so last three rounds kind of made all the weight worth it, the trash talk, all of that. We just said, we had two warriors here. And you get that with British title fights on the rare occasion. We had it with Groves and DeGale. I'm sure we've had it with Billy Joe. Was it Billy Joe Eubank or Billy Joe John Ryder? We've had those sorts of fights where it's two guys who are trying to prove something. Normally of vastly different pedigrees as well, so that's what makes it compelling. And you get really interesting, compelling fights. Other times it's kind of just a, you know, old guy passing the rub on to the young guy. But in this instance, two hungry guys going for it. And wow, what a fight. One judge had it for Clark, one judge had it for Wardley, one had it 113-113. I felt it was a 113-113 type card. You give Frazier 7 rounds, Fabio 5, and this is what I mean about the knockdown and the point deduction then become significant factors in that. But even now recording this, I'm just like, what a fight that was. You won't see many fights like that. And if you think, as soon as that bell went, Frazier didn't make it to the stool. Fabio's hanging off the ropes. You know what I mean? Fabio's corner was just telling him, keep standing, keep standing. Frazier was just in a lump on the floor. And I was just like, well, there you go. That's what it meant to both of them. When you see that, there's no other sport like boxing. When you see that moment, and you're like, they, it's not that they gave everything. They found something within themselves they didn't know they had. And some people say, are you ever the same after that kind of fight? Yes, you are, because, and this is going to sound paradoxical, neither man really took a hiding in there. I know there was the cut and Fabio's eye, but once Fabio was stitched up and cleaned up, he didn't look that bad. And like, you know, Fraser's not the heaviest of punchers, but he's got a hell of a chin as well. So it looked more like those guys were just knackered from being big men that had never done that distance before. So hopefully that hasn't had any lasting effects, because we might need to see that again. So we end up with scorecards of what? 114, 113, Wardley. 115, 112, Clark. And then 113, 113. Which would suggest that without the point deduction, you know, Fraser wins that. Without the knockdown, Fraser wins that. Which is a reminder, then, stay disciplined and focus on your defense, because those lapses can cost you. And I remember after that fight thinking, this is going to crush Fraser Clark. This is going to really crush Fraser Clark. Because you got to think, just under 3 years ago, he was in Tokyo, winning an Olympic bronze medal. He was captain of Team GB. He was our super heavyweight. He was carrying the mantle, Joshua Gold, Joyce Silver, Fraser Clark bronze. And I'm sure in his head, he was like, I should really be dealing with guys like this the same way Joshua dealt with Dillian White, the same way Joe Joyce dealt with Ian Lewison. In his head, he would have thought that. This is how you deal with these guys. You show them why you are better. You show them why you went to the Olympics. And the fact that he got taken the stretch, that will hurt him. That will have him questioning himself. Am I who I thought I was? Am I as good as I think I am? Can I get any better than I am now? What can I do differently? Because in his head, he's like, I can't lose to a Fabio Wardley. A guy who turned pro in 2017. By then, Fraser Clark was on the road to Tokyo. Fraser will be cut. He'll be cut up. He'll be... I feel for him, because imagine you go all the way back up to Burt and see your family, and you know, yes, it was a split decision draw, but you know that fight was harder than you expected it to be. That fight was harder than it needed to be. And there was nothing you could do in that fight to change the course of that fight. Fraser Clark realized that he's not far away from his natural ceiling. And he doesn't have a belt to show for it, unfortunately. If you turn around and look at Fabio, Fabio will look at that and go, I can be better. I genuinely think if Fabio fought that fight again, he could be better. He could definitely not ship as many jabs to the face as he did. But he'll be grateful, like, I've got this fight out the way, got these belts, I can move on and go and do other stuff, because he will also realize he's not far away from his natural ceiling. So he might need to get a couple more of those Saudi Arabian checks and move on. But the thing about these two guys is the rematch is always there for them. That rematch, based on the first fight, that rematch will capture the public's attention. That rematch will sell out the O2. You will have 18,000 in the O2 to see those two go at it again. Someone tweeted it, so I don't want to steal credit, and I can't remember who it was, but they said, that's our Gatti Ward. I don't know if I'd go that far, but also, if you're going to say it's a heavyweight version of Gatti Ward, then yeah, I would go that far. But that's a fight we will happily revisit as fans. Don't make it pay-per-view, because then we have different expectations of it, but definitely have that back in the O2. You'll sell the O2 out with the right undercard, because we know those guys won't take a backward step. And as fans, that's all we ask for, right? All we ask for as boxing fans, When something's a main event, give us two men or two women who are prepared to leave everything in the ring. We're tired of being told something's a main event when we really know it's not. We're tired of being told something's pay-per-view only because they want to overpay someone for something that fans don't value. What we got on Sunday was something that made perfect sense. I don't know what both men go on to do after this. I think if you're Fraser Clark, you have a couple of rebuilding fights, work on some stuff. I think he's got to come in 17 and a half stone. Him being that big, he's not powerful enough to be that big. There's been this trend in heavyweight boxing, and it's probably come from this newer wave of coaches. You know, sometimes you see a video on the internet and you think it's a good idea in theory. And it's this idea that if you can get your guy bigger and carrying a little extra timber, he can absorb the shots better. And so that the idea of that is muscles generally less mobile than fat. But it's that motion that dissipates the shock, like an F1 car. The reason an F1 car disintegrates on impact is it takes all the energy away from the driver. And it's the same idea in boxing. When you see Fury's fat just rippling, that's all energy that's going out before it gets to the ground, and who knows what happens after that. So there's been an increasing trend towards having that in your heavyweights. Now, that's all well and good for taking shots, but it's ruining them for stamina. And what it's also doing is creating the incentive to use things like EPO. Instead, I'd like to see these guys do more road work, actually focus on getting their cardio up, getting their resting heart rate all the way down, and then let's see where they arrive at weight-wise. You know, I imagine if Fraser did that, he'd be back to his kind of amateur weight, which is mid to top end of 17 stone, and he'd be more effective at that weight. It's just my opinion. You look at Fabio, last few years he's been pretty consistent in terms of being around that 240 pounds mark, give or take a couple. So he seems to be in control of his fight weight. But I think having gone the 12 for the first time, he's going to understand maybe I could be built a little differently. But also, the strange thing is, like, I've seen both men up close and personal. Like, John Pallata boxed Fraser in the amateurs. I remember that might have been Fraser's last ever fight up in Burton. And we lost on a split. But Fraser couldn't live with the pace that we set. You know, chin was solid as anything because he took some hellacious left hooks. But he couldn't live with the pace. So we knew once we got that split that we'd actually done enough to win. But you've got to send your hometown hero off the right way. And then Fabio, same with JP. He spent a lot of time at Don Charles's gym, so there'd be Derek, JP, Don, Tom Little, occasionally Brian Jennings would be there. And so I got to see Fabio up close. I think I've told the story before of how they all tried to sign Fabio. But liked him then. Yeah. The thing I always like about Fabio is he's relatable. I think sometimes when boxers come from, especially London, and you guys are listeners, so tell me what you think about this. When people come from London, they're a bit too London, and it's not relatable to the rest of the country. Whereas Fabio Wardley, relatable to the rest of the country. Like when you saw him during lockdown, and he had his dogs in the van, and he's taking them for a walk, and he's talking to Eddie Hearn live on Instagram. And you're like, everyone's got a mate like Fabio. He's got that kind of David Hayness to him, where he's relatable to all demographics in the country. I feel the same about Fraser as well. I think those two guys are relatable, and that's kind of the popularity. They're not too anywhere specific. They're not too Manchester. They're not too London. They're not too Leeds. They're guys you imagine you could meet anywhere. You could be on holiday. You could bump into them. And that's part of their appeal. Rematch next? Hopefully not. Let both guys go away, learn some new tricks, build up some stamina, and then bring him back around when it makes sense to do so. You never know, the Saudis may even pay for that fight. The next fight I want to talk about is Ben Whittaker versus Leon Willings. I think I mentioned at the beginning that you always need a reality check on a good fight card, and I think Ben got one. So where do you even position Leon Willings? Because he lost to Robbie Chapman. And you, as people know, if you know Robbie Chapman well, you know Robbie's a journeyman. Like, he's not really trying to win. Do you know what I mean? But he lost to Robbie, and Robbie's a good fighter, solid guy, like, knows his way around the ring now. So you look at that and you go, well, Ben should have an easy time with him, right? And actually, on a side note, it's interesting that he's got quite a similar style to Robbie now, where they try and use his shoulder roll and they try and count it with the right hands. And I don't know if he got that off Robbie, but I was watching that going, that is a bit Robbie Chapman-ish. But, you know, our expectations of Ben are he's going to do the dancing and he's going to do the stoppage, right? They're the two things we expect, the showboating and the stoppage. And we're okay with that. Let's touch on the spat he had with Andy Clark. I understand where Ben's coming from when he's pulling Andy Clark up about using that word disrespectful. And here's why. When you're commentating to, let's just say, hundreds of thousands of people on Sky, you're affecting not only the perception of that fight. And yes, most people listening here, your views are influenced by the commentary. On God, watch it without the commentary and see how different a fight is. Because what the commentary does is it helps you make sense of the fight without having to think too much. The same way that people watch the news because they want to know what's going on in the world without having to think too much. That's why the mainstream media is dangerous. So when Andy Clark is broadcasting and he's using words like disrespectful, it sits in the mind of the audience. But oftentimes what we call disrespectful isn't fair. It's not right. And I'll give you an example. Does anyone remember Calzaghe? Remember when Calzaghe would hit you with like 8 shots, take a step back, put his hands on his hips, and he'd wiggle his hips. And the crowd would cheer. Andy Clark wouldn't call that disrespectful because it's Joe Calzaghe. And I'm not even talking about Joe doing that against elite level guys. He's doing that against like your kind of sub David Starry type guys. So when Andy Clark uses that word disrespectful, it affects perception. It affects how the fans view Ben Whittaker. So it's a very dangerous word to use because you'd have to be very clear that Ben intends to disrespect that guy. As opposed to putting on a show and being an exhibitionist, which is maybe the better way to describe what Ben Whittaker does. But if we then move it on a level, Dan Aziz does the color commentary. And Dan goes, look, we came here to see some showboating and a knockout. Like, we didn't come to see all of this going the distance stuff. And yes, Dan probably has a dog in the race, but he was 100% right. Ben Whittaker's created that expectation that when we see Ben, we're going to get a show, we're going to get a knockout. Now, those in boxing know that's not always going to happen. And that's okay. So you focus on what were the good things that Ben did. It was good to see the nastiness in Ben Whittaker. There were points in that fight where there was real nastiness when he let his hands go. Could he work on his punch mechanics a bit? Potentially. I still think he's a bit slow in whipping the hips over, but that will come with time. He's throwing the right combinations. They flow wonderfully well. He's still hard to hit. It didn't look like he had stamina issues. Didn't look like he got bullied in there. So all the boxes were ticked, but we got that reality check of he ain't going to blow everyone out. And so then you go, okay, so where is he now? We can't talk about him fighting Dan Aziz. I don't even think you want to wheel out an Andre Sterling. You know, bring Andre out of semi-retirement. So who do you put him in with next? Because you've got two roads you can go down. You can go down this road of, okay, he's fought at area level, and that was a bit of a jolly for him. So let's find someone who's at or around English level. You know, let me find someone like a Joel McIntyre who's kind of been at that level and you can kind of oversell the name. You could dig up another South Coast legend, so Louis Edmondson, you could dig up because he's been calling out Ben Whittaker as well. But do you want to put Ben in that position this early in his career? or do you want to do that for a belt? That's going to be the real question. When do you start putting Ben in for these belts? I don't know the answer to that. His team will know, but you got to start looking at that now. Like, what's his real path to development? Because the problem is, you've got guys like Joel McIntyre, right, that you could fight. Then you've got kind of like guys like Shikan Pitters, where it starts to get a bit gnarly at that kind of British level. But once you start beating guys like Shikan Pitters, you're kind of into the monster league now. You're into your Boatsies, Dan Azizas, Craig Richards, and so forth. So he almost hasn't got, there's not much time for him to learn before he's got to go and swim with those sharks. And I think that will give his team that kind of reality check. Like, look, there's some things we need to work on here. Maybe we need to start focusing on breaking guys down. And this is all stuff I know Ben can do. But you're going to start having to have strategies to break people down. Start identifying weaknesses in people and really going after that. I think that's where you want to get to. It'll be interesting to see who he picks as his new trainer, seeing as he's split with Sugar Hill Stewart. My own opinion, you go with someone like Dom Ingle. Because Dom's been there. Like Dom's been in gyms with larger-than-life characters. Like the style that Ben Whitaker's got isn't unusual to Dom and the Ingle family. Being a larger-than-life character, the showboating isn't unusual to them. Like it's all water off a duck's back to those guys. And maybe that's what Ben needs. It would also help that you've got a kid like Goldsmith in there. Ben Goldsmith. Is it Ben? Hopefully it is. Yeah. You got him in there. Brad Goldsmith. So you got a decent standard of fighter in there. And plus that gym just draws quality fighters anyway. So I don't know. I think it was a good win for Ben. But the time to make positive changes in a career, I think, is when you're winning. Because that shows that you're retaining the initiative. You don't want to wait till it's too late. But yeah, I think that was a good reality check for Ben. You're not going to blow everyone out of there. So sometimes you got to break people down. And he'll learn that, man. He's in that space. Another person who maybe got a slight reality check will be Vidal Riley. I've told the story on here when I got quite a pissy message from one of his training team, Russ Gerrard. And like, I'm not mad at Russ anymore. Like, I understand where it came from. He's just trying to do the best for his team. He's going to bat for his team. I hope they're paying him, though. I hope he's getting a good cut of that money. So what do you say about Vidal Riley versus Mikel Lowell? Disappointing. Bit of a letdown. Damp squib. Yeah, that's that. For all the talk we've heard about who he's going to fight, what he's going to do, what level he's at, the Mikel Lowell fight showed us maybe he's not quite there yet. Because Mikel Lowell's got power, but Mikel Lowell is limited. And that hurts me, by the way, because his team have had long enough to start crafting a fight style for him. He doesn't need to be that heavy-footed. He doesn't always have to follow his opponents. He doesn't always have to throw heavy shots. There's no structure to what Mikel Lowell does. There's so many things that you'd want to fix with Mikel Lowell. Because there's something there. There's something there. There's a guy that, if you can just have a solid year of getting him disciplined and focused, that there's a guy there that could win. But I'm also saying this as an outsider looking in. I don't know if they've taught him all these things and he just doesn't want to do it. Who knows? But based on what I saw, there's a lot more that he could give. My worry with Vidal Riley was, at no point did Vidal look dominant in that fight. Because what you're going to do naturally is you're going to compare that performance with Isaac Chamberlain's performance. Isaac looked dominant because Isaac took shots. Took his shots, came back, let him know. And this is the difference. This is what seasoning does. This is what experience is. Experience gives you that confidence and that courage to be in the eye of the storm and do what you do. That's what happened. People will tell you, oh, that was a masterclass. He kept it on the outside of the ring. The commentators were lying to you. That was just hit and run and just hope you nick a decision. They did not want to engage with Mikel Lowell at all. Yeah? And you know my view on this, and I've said this about Lerone Richards. When you're not prepared to give the fans what they paid their money for, don't expect the fans to care about your career. We've been asking questions about Vidal for a long time. Where are these YouTube viewers? If you've got this many million followers, and I have no reason to doubt that, why don't they show up? Why is he not shifting 8, 10,000 tickets? Why can't he shift pay-per-views? None of it makes any sense to me. I keep being told how many followers people have and this, that, and the blase blah. I don't see him modeling for Diesel. I don't see him being offered endorsements with Adidas with the following he supposedly has. And I'm not saying this to shoot him down. Like, Vidal Riley's a talented kid, but there's a conversation that needs to happen between Ben Shalom and his team that says, if you're not prepared to entertain the fans, I can't push you how you want to be pushed. They just signed the contract with him, and then he gives that performance. All that saved that fight was that Isaac Chamberlain showed up. Right? That saved the fight. Isaac Chamberlain showed up. Like, Isaac rolled his sleeves up and said, look, let me make the cruiserweight division interesting again. Showed up. Describe the fight the way that you should describe the fight, as complete ass. And he wasn't wrong. But he brought that energy to that situation that was needed. Like, it's almost like Isaac got there and realized that Vidal didn't know how to sell the fight. And Isaac's like, you're messing my money up. Let me take over. I like that. Isaac was like, oh, hold on, young pup. Let me take over. Yeah. let the prize asset be the prize asset. And then it was just utter mayhem, which was brilliant. And my lesson is, I'm going to stop texting Isaac Chamberlain during fights. Because that's all I was just going back and forth with him about that fight. And I was like, mate, you sure you want to do this fight next? You know, I'd actually just like to see him vacate and then just go and fight for the European. Let Vidal learn. Vidal's got a few more fights at that Mikel Wilde level. Until he can show us a dominant performance at that level, let's not talk about Chamberlain, because that would be almost like five steps back after what happened on Sunday. But yeah, I think Vidal's got that reality check of, yo, there's some big boys in this division. Big boys that hit hard. And you can't have a whole career running around the edge of the ring. Because at some point, you're going to meet someone like Isaac that cuts the ring off. You're going to meet someone like Isaac who's got just as good a jab as you do. And you ain't going to be able to go anywhere. And if you have aspirations to win those belts, look at the guys with the belts. Guys like Jai Oppertaia. You're not running away from guys like that. And I'm sure at some point I'll get another message from Russ Jarrett going, you don't know what you're talking about. So let me say this again so I'm absolutely clear. I think Vidal Riley is super talented. He's just got a decision to make. Do you want to go down the Isaac Chamberlain route of winning the hearts of your boxing fans through being vulnerable in that ring and putting yourself in harm's way and prevailing? Or do you want to go the Lerone Richards route and go, I'm just going to do it my way because that's all I want to do? I don't know what the answer to that is. What I can tell you is there's more money in having the hearts and the love of the fans than there is any other way. So hopefully that they'll reflect and go, we need to be better than that. So now we've got to come on to the redemption tale. And like, the Chris Congo journey is one I've followed for God knows how long, man. Like, just the whole family. Elvis, Obed, now Chris. Boxing royalty in Southeast London. Always put Southeast London on the map. Between the Lynn and the Fisher, these guys have put boxing on the map. So I've got a lot of respect for that family, you know. You call them boxing's first family, I'm not sure. But Chris had kind of had missteps. I think the Echo Esterman fight was probably a good example of that, where He almost fought the way he wanted to fight and not necessarily the way that he needed to do in order to win. And it was frustrating watching it because you knew Chris was capable of more. But it was another occasion, I think Malcolm McKinson was the other, where you're like, has he got it at this level? Like, you knew the talent was there because you see it regularly. And he's a great guy. entertaining guy, compelling guy. There's a lot to like about Chris, but he hadn't had that signature performance. That performance that said, this is what Chris Kongo can do. And I think Florian Marku was a great dance partner. So it was the reverse of Wardley versus Clark in the sense that Chris Kongo was able to use his pedigree to create clear water between him and Florian Marku. By being a dynamic target and just not letting his feet settle, Florian couldn't get close enough to just tee off with those big meaty hooks. And Florian was swinging by all means. He just couldn't get his distance right because Chris wouldn't let him. Feints, jabs, moving all the time. And that's what I like to see with Chris. There was a bit of spite in there as well. Once he knew that he was kind of, once he knew he had crested the hill, then he put some mustard in those shots. And I think there was a point towards the end of the fight you could see Florian was almost like, what's the point? I think he had almost turned Florian off. Like, Florian's like, what's the point? What am I doing this for? And then he was just fighting for pride at that point. So credit to Chris Kongo. What do you do with him? Does he fight Esselman again to get that W back? Do you put him in with Harry Scarf? You know, Harry's a messy fighter, but Chris has got that pedigree where he should be able to tame a kid like Harry Scarf. So why not let Chris fight for and win the British? Or do you go another route, man? Like, welterweight seems open at the world level, so do you try and sneak in that way? When you get a win like Marku, man, it gives you options. So I'd like to see what he does next, but I'm so, so happy for Chris because Chris has always been that guy. You know, everyone knows that there's always a guy that's really, really talented and they just needed a break. And hopefully this is the break that Chris needed in order to now go and fulfill his potential. Because we want to see how good he can be. Because, like, you hear it from Londoners a lot saying, yeah, Chris Kongo is really good, but we'd like the whole country to see what we see. So we've got to talk about Callum Simpson. So Callum Simpson fights Mbabe. Forget his first name. But remember him. He's boxed British fighters before. Difficult to read. Unpredictable. You're the sort of guy that, if you're not on your game, can be an absolute nightmare, especially if he gets his confidence up. But Callum Simpson. Wow. Tamed the beast pretty quickly. Stops him in the fourth round with one of my favorite stoppages in a long time. I think he must have thrown about three or four left uppercuts. Gone in with a left hook. And that would have been enough. We're like, that was really good work. Followed it up with the right hand. And a lot of people forget the value in following up. Because when you follow up, like most people are used to one punch, two punch, three punches. If you can break that rhythm and then throw four or five, you'll find that there are openings that even your opponent hadn't thought there'd be. So just seeing that in Callum Simpson lets me know that he's a thinking fighter. And it's not like he's like a raw novice. He's been a pro for nearly 5 years. So we can't act surprised that we're seeing this. But just the quality, the poise in what he does and how clean and how technically sound he... There's a lot to like about Callum Simpson. When you watch him, you go, it's got to be quite hard to beat at super mid. I think he's meant to be fighting Zach Chelly next, right? Whew. Barry and the boys of State of Mind will have their work cut out because what you don't want to be is on the receiving end of what Callum Simpson does. You have to maul that guy. It's got to be double jab, shoot straight in, pushing back, big right hand, go to the body. You've got to make it so nasty, like you're not going to outbox someone like Callum Simpson. You're just not. So you've got to take him to a place where he's uncomfortable. You got to maul him. You got to just pull him apart. But look, he looks the part. Like if you were to say to someone, what's a good example of a good technical boxer who makes good decisions in the ring, throws good combinations that make sense? Callum Simpson's the name you'd point to. We just need to see that at the higher level, which would be, for example, Zach Chelly. But I enjoyed watching that fight. Like, it was a showcase fight, and showcase is exactly what it did for Callum Simpson. It let people know that this young man here, whoo, he's going to have a big say in the super middleweight division for a while. So I'm looking forward to that fight when it happens. So I was happy for him. Last fight we need to talk about is Alan Babbage versus Steve Robinson. Both men did what they do, and Babbage was always going to catch up to him in the end. Was it stopped a bit prematurely? Potentially. But what's the point in Steve Robinson taking all those shots, and it's not even for a belt? So I understand why the ref stopped it when he did. I would question why Steve Robinson is still boxing on Sky. They must have one of those 5 or 6 fight contracts with him, because right now it's not making a lot of sense. There are other heavyweights you could pluck up the small hall scene. If that's what you need, you could just ask Phil Williams to sign a contract. You could ask Chris Healy to sign a contract. If you need tough people to take shots against guys like Alan Babbage. And it's not to discount what Steve Robinson's achieved in his life, right? Because he's been a good kid. He's done great things. But in the amateurs, he came up short against all these other people who are coming through now. Like, he wasn't a standout. I don't know who went to boxer and said, this kid's the real deal. And that's what a lot of trainers and managers do. They sell hopes and dreams. And the reality is, what they have isn't up to standard. Like, you compare someone with a Steve Robinson with a Callum Simpson. For me, Callum Simpson is the benchmark. You should be like that if you aspire to go pro. Not necessarily the same style, but that level of accomplishment, that polish, where you go, yeah, you look like you know what you're doing now. And a lot of times we turn people over who are half-baked, and then we're surprised when they turn out to be terrible under pressure. But most pros you see in this country are half-baked because they don't go through the process the right way. There's a reason why you go up the levels and you don't skip levels, because that's how you do your education. I just wish more people understood that. So how do you summarize the show? Fabio Wardy, Fraser Clark. Neither man should get too down, man. Like, whatever they think of themselves today, the truth is probably a lot better than they think it is. There'll be opponents out there where Fraser Clark will look good. And he shouldn't be afraid to chase those opportunities. Forget trying to mess around at British level. Why not find some of these smaller heavyweights that you can rumble with, like a Michael Hunter? Jumping with a Michael Hunter, just have that fight. For Fabio, same thing. Just find guys that work for you. Don't always chase what the fans want you to do. Go and find some entertaining fights, man. Just jump in there. You know, why not call out a Chisora, for example? Although, you know, having been stablemates, probably not. But those sorts of names, just call out names and say, look, why can't Fabio Wardy fight Huey Fury when he's match fit? Let's see. You know, Fabio Wardy, Cash Alley, why not? Chris Congo, don't mind the Harry Scarf fight. If you want to take him international, welterweight's open, so why not? Ben Whittaker, they'll find Joel McIntyre for him, why not? Let him jump in with Joel McIntyre on a Billum Smith show in Bournemouth. It seems to make the most amount of sense at the moment. Callum Simpson's got Zach Chelly. I think that'll be a good fight. Hopefully they put it on the right card. Like, I don't want that. God, I'm going to sound like an ass. If they tell me that's a headliner for like Wembley, I'm like, this is why Sky will pull out of boxing. It needs to be part of like a solid card. Chelly versus Simpson on like a Billum Smith React Poor card, I could get behind that. Babbage and Steve Robinson. Babbage and Drago. Keep him on. Maybe not Drago, but keep Babbage on, because he'll always give you that entertainment. Just find him good dance partners and he'll be all good. Vidal Riley. What do you do with Vidal? I said Luke Watkins. Luke Watkins or one of these light heavyweights that's going to come up. Put him in with Callum Johnson. Yeah, if he's that good, put him in with Callum Johnson. They won't, because Callum Johnson can bang and he can box, even though he is getting on a bit. So I think I just summarise that by saying, good card by Boxer and Sky Sports, the solid card. Let me word this carefully. It shows that when given the reins, Ben Shalom can pull something together. He doesn't always need other people interfering. So I'm glad that he got to prove that. And maybe we can get behind him a bit more. And let's listen to him a bit when he says he knows what he's doing. So now, credit to him. And that card was a massive shot in the arm for British boxing. Happy for Chris Kongo. Massive shot in the arm for London boxing. And it was good to see that there was a nice spread of geographies on that card so the whole country could get behind it. Maybe that's what Sky need to do in the interim to keep the product exciting. And on that note, let me tap out and say, listen, enjoy your day. As always, you know, if you love the product, share it, get more people involved. You know, it makes the support makes the live tweeting far more entertaining. So I appreciate that. Thank you, guys. Take care.